Welcome everyone to a Wagon Wheel, the podcast where you ask questions about cricket. We haven't had a lot of cricket today, so luckily we have all these questions just in our back pocket, ready to go, right? If you're on YouTube, the best way to ask a question, as always, is via the Super Chat function. And if you're not on YouTube or the timings don't work for you, the best way is via Patreon. So patreon.com/goodareaspodcast is the place to go. And then you can send a question in, like Jane has, who says, what can England realistically do to improve their limited over squad? Yes, they have a tendency to play some dumb cricket, but I'm not sure this squad has it in them to compete either. I don't know from who the domestic level can translate their game to international. They specifically seem to have issues both playing spin and having a good spin bowling attack, barring Rashid. It's really interesting. So that's kind of been my point of recent times. I was interested to see what McCullum could do because I wasn't expecting Bazball, right? Like, no one was expecting Bazball, but I wasn't expecting it to work. But if you think about Bazball comes from a position of strength because essentially he was saying, well, we're very, very good at white ball cricket. So let's continue to be very good at white ball cricket. Do it in the red ball. What do you do now when you're not particularly good in test or white ball cricket, or certainly not at the levels that they need to be or anything else, right? So the spin thing you talk about is really important. And I think that's a big part of it. Also kind of, you look at their bowling attack and you look at the all-rounders coming through, like the great sides for England had so many all-rounders. They don't have that anymore, right? So they don't have the batting depth, which means that their batting has to change the way it thinks about the game. And they've gone all in on one plan, which I still don't think is a terrible plan. It just, I can't see how it's going to work everywhere, is my issue. Now, again, I think this is McCullum going, well, what's our strength at the moment? Our strength is we have three or four guys who can bowl 90 miles an hour. Let's use that. That's not a bad move. It's just not working, right? So I don't think we should judge them too harshly. I see Inflatable Cactus that says, get rid of Baz. Like, he's just taken over this side. So it's not as if the Champions Trophy losses are massively on his shoulders. But I feel like we've already seen them go up against India and look underwhelming. They played one game against Australia, and again, it hasn't worked. Those are the teams they have to beat. Like, South Africa's the only other side. South Africa's the only other side that you have to go up against, right? From that perspective, and maybe New Zealand you could throw in at the moment. Those are the four teams that you have to be able to beat. Will they be able to go off and beat Pakistan easily and the West Indies and Sri Lanka and Bangladesh? Maybe even Afghanistan, although I'm not 100% sure they'll beat Afghanistan, but maybe Afghanistan as well. Probably, right? But they have to be able to beat the best sides. And in four games, they haven't looked particularly good against the best sides. But there's no way that they could have perfected this method as well. If you come in and you play, you've only played a handful of games and you're under new management, that just doesn't, the same way I wouldn't give McCullum credit if they'd won. He made some slight tweaks. You would give him a little bit of credit, but it's not his side. But I do feel we have now seen enough to be like, okay, so we could see what you are doing different. And they've made a change on the fly as well. The Australia game, they've already made one change, so they're thinking about it. I was talking to Vish from Cricket Info the other day about this, and he was saying they've gone all in on strike bowlers. Do they need more defensive bowlers? And I was like, I watched the Blast last year. I watched a lot of the 100. Who are the defensive bowlers that we think would come in and make a genuine change? I'm a big fan of Payne. I think he's a really clever bowler. I don't think he's going to change this side. Benny Howell is no longer the force that he once was. I'm not sure there are that many England bowlers out there that are going to come in and change it. And the same with the batting. Tom Batten's a really interesting one for me because when he first came on the scene, I basically said he was massively overrated. And he's now developed into the kind of cricketer that I think justifies why he was picked early. But it seems to me like a lot of English players come in and they're very one-dimensional. They're very good at hitting right on pace a long distance over mid-wicket. That, at the moment, you compare that to the top Indian batters, the top South African batters, the top Australian batters. They're just different. And so I don't see anyone in the lower levels. And to go back to the old 2008 to 2012 period, which England, you know, didn't find all these players, and you go back to that, and there's so many players just smashing the ball everywhere. Like, one of the more impressive players that I saw in England this year was Tom Abel. I'm a big fan of Tom Abel as a professional cricketer. I just don't see how, what would Tom Abel be? Where are we? He's a 30-year-old who late in his career has sort of worked out, I think, how to get the most out of himself. Like, I don't think he's going to transform anything from that point of view. And if you go back to, as I said, that 2008 to 2012 period, which is the period I moved to the UK and I watched tons of cricket, everyone was making a lot of runs, and they were making every year. My computer's just absolutely had one there. If you go back and you have a look at in that period, like, there were lots of people making lots of runs consistently. And I think if you go now, I'm just trying to have a look. So the guys who made the runs in the 100 in last year, so Vince, obviously not changing the future. Duckett, Salt, there's your openers. Puran was the other one. Cox is interesting, going ahead. Banton, who we've already discussed. Then you've got Hales. Sam Curran made a lot of runs in that tournament, and no one else made over 200 runs in the tournament, if I'm right in saying. So the guys who made the runs are in the side. The only person you would throw in from out of this is Cox. And Sam Curran had a fairly decent tournament if they want to go that way again, but they'd have to pick him as a batter. And I think at the international level, and even at the IPL level, as we've seen, he's probably not quite a batter. He's probably just, you know, a couple of degrees below that. So these aren't easy things to fix, right? It's, you know, that's just where we are at the moment. Okay. MF Jim says, is it a bad sign for the Champions Trophy that there have been more exciting cap moments, 3 or 4s, than matches? Can we get an end of tournament cat analysis? Will cats do better on the internet, MF Jim? Look, it's been a bad tournament so far. The washout today makes it much worse. But it has been a bad tournament so far, hasn't it? Like, I don't think anyone would look at what we've seen here and think to themselves that it's been good. We haven't had a particularly close game. The best game was probably England-Australia, and that petered out towards the end as well. I was listening to the BBC commentary because I had to pick up Clem at the end of that game, and I think it was Agnew and Vic Marks were on together, and they were just like, we thought this was going to be at least close. Like, it wasn't close, right? So it's been a poor tournament so far, but sometimes that happens. Do you remember we had that Women's World Cup during COVID? In the one in New Zealand, where, like, every game was close. But what can you do? Sometimes you get one of them and sometimes you get one of these. But I'm not as au fait with the cat stuff. I leave that to my wife. Amit says, given the current state of Indian ODI team, where Kyle Rahul almost never gets to bat before the 35th over, and sometimes not even that, would it not be better if India plays Rishabh Pant ahead of him, especially when Rishabh, to me, is a much better keeper? Is he the only in the team in case the top order collapse? And then will we need someone like KL to take us to a defendable total? Yeah, he's in there as the insurance. He can, I've seen him play some good innings coming in lower down the order as well and hitting out. He doesn't quite have the same level of hitting ability that Rishabh Pant does. But if we remember young KL Rahul and occasional KL Rahul, he can still do that. So what they're really doing is, as you said, if they find themselves 3 down without many runs, KL can go in and hit an automatic 100. You know, and that's what they want, another player who can do that. And then at the end, they have him and other people to hit. If you trust your batting order to do exactly what it should do every single time, you probably wouldn't need KL Rahul. You probably have someone more like Sky in that position, or Rishabh Pant, although even though Rishabh Pant probably plays within himself a little bit more than he needs to, but Sky, maybe Tilak Varma, those sorts of players. But where they are at the moment, they've decided that with Rohit going so hard at the top, and possibly with Virat not being as automatic as he has been in the past, that they're giving themselves a little bit more flexibility there and or insurance. I don't have any issue with that at all. Manon says, what are general skills that left-arm pace bowlers should work on to possess and what can make them be unplayable? Also, the difference between a left-armer who could swing it into righties and one who could swing it away instead. So this is a thing right across left-arm bowlers. Right-arm bowlers tend to be more skillful and have more tricks, right? And that's because they have to, because in order to be a great right-arm bowler or a professional right-arm bowler, chances are you can't just run in and hit the top of off stump over and over again. Where if you're a left-arm finger spinner, like 70% of the time, you just need to run in, pitch the ball on middle stump and straighten it, and you automatically got a huge advantage over off spinners, right? And a left-arm bowler, a left-arm pace bowler, exactly the same. It's a different angle. Not everyone plays left-arm bowl. Everyone plays right-arm bowling well, right? There's almost no players in the history of the game who don't play right-arm seam bowling well. There are plenty of players who don't play left-arm seam well. And then you have, you know, a variability. So it means that when we're developing left-arm bowlers, I think we just go, now you just worry about making sure that you can swing the ball back in and then angle it across afterwards. Whereas actually what we should be saying is, once you've learned how to swing the ball back in and control that part of your game, right, now we're going to work on how to swing the ball away. One of the reasons it's harder for left-arm bowlers to swing the ball away is because they are so grooved to swing it in one direction. And there aren't that many players who could swing it in both directions. But that's the next thing that you want to be able to do. And what you really want left-arm seamers to do, and we've seen this a little bit with Mustafa Zahraman and Mitchell Johnson, is just come around the wicket and create a new angle where you are moving the ball away from right-handers. That makes you Wasim Akram, right? That takes you to a level where you are one of the greatest players of all time once you start to do that. We've seen Bolt try this, and I think if Bolt was 5 or 10 years younger, I just reckon he would be doing this more naturally. I saw Mitchell Johnson bowl cutters around the wicket a few times, and I was like, oh, that's the future. Left-armers bowling cutters around the wicket, right? Especially if they are fast, like Mitchell Johnson. I've seen Mustafiza do it as well. Almost impossible to play. But I think you need to be able to do it with swing bowling as well, and give yourself that. That's what left-arm bowlers should be doing. But it is hard because their bodies are grooved in a way to bring the ball in the other direction. And it works for them against right-handers and left-handers, right? So you can understand why it doesn't happen. But I think it's partly bad coaching and partly when you have such a natural advantage. You know, you look at those, you look at tennis. There's so many really good tennis players who are left-handers with a big booming serve, right? And they just slice the ball over and over again because it means anyone else is having to chase down and return a backhand to them. And in the days of double-handed backhands, you can't reach as far as you used to be able to reach, right? So left-handed servers in tennis are probably as one-dimensional as left-arm bowlers are everywhere else. And you probably get that across an array of different sports where being a left-hander is an advantage. But if you have a young left-armer, you know, it's up to you to train them. So, you know, I was really lucky with Ezekiel. He's only 10, but he has a natural in-swinger, right? So I don't have to do anything with that ball. I just say to him, in-swinger, he puts the seam in the right direction, and about if there's anything in that ball, he'll get it to swing, right? But what I then say to him is, okay, now I need to see the off cutter, right? Now I need to see the leg cutter. Now I want you to come around the wicket and try, and that's what you're trying to encourage, and that's what should be happening at the professional level. But it's hard because a lot of old coaches will just say to left-armers, nah, you don't need to do that. And to say, you see the same thing with tall bowlers. Right? Tall bowlers try and pitch it up and swing it, and old coaches go, you don't need to do that. I think we need to, if you really want your player to be at the best, you want to give them as many different bites at the cherry as possible. William says, why is Phil Salt just not working as a 50-over opener? England have as attacking openers before, who all have the ability to both attack in the power play and go long. Is it to do with his technique? Can't speak. He's a bit sloggy. He has made runs in ODIs, hasn't he? So what's he averaging? 33? So what would that be compared to Jason Roy? I know it's not from a lot of ODIs at the moment, but I would have thought Jason Roy would have averaged around 33 as well. Let's have a look. Jason Roy was 39. Yeah, it's quite a bit higher, isn't it? I don't think 33 is terrible with a strike rate of 114. I think the issue at the moment is clearly McCullum has told him to go full whack. I thought he played really well. I'd have to go back and have a look at his full record, but I thought he played really well before that in ODI cricket when he was just kind of, I don't want to say playing within himself, but not putting the foot down. So he made the 100 against the Netherlands. I probably commentated that one. And then we've got, the West Indies. So he made 59 off 59 balls in the West Indies. He made a 74 off 108. So it wasn't that long ago that he was batting for longer in ODI cricket. Now, that's not against as good a team. And if you look at his record, he's mostly made runs against Ireland, West Indies, and the Netherlands, right? So he hasn't really been tested against the best teams. But the opener I saw him in the West Indies, I was like, that's a really good player because at any stage he can hit a four or a six. So he's always keeping the bowling team worried, but he was also playing the right balls at the right time. What I've seen over the last month is he's just gone back to slog mode. And against the best bowlers in the world, they just work you out. And so if I was having a conversation with, England or Phil Salt directly, I'd be like, do you need to do this? Because I think he can score at a strike rate of 120, right, without slogging. So do that, and then on the day when everything's going in your favor, that's when you press the accelerator down. And then on the days when it's not in your favor, you just score it a run a ball. He has that ability, and that turns him into more of a Jason Roy type player for me. The only thing, because their team's such a mess at the moment, England, like because Duckett has become so important to especially when they play in Asia, I almost wonder if now that they want Salt to go even harder, right? And that's why Jamie Smith came up the order to make up for the fact that Duckett won't always score as quickly, which just tells you how many different issues they have in this side on a minute-by-minute basis. A quick break here. We'll be back with more Wagon Wheel. Cricket media used to be pretty simple. Find your favourite newspaper, head to Cricket Info, and maybe a blog you'd like. Now just finding the best stories and writing is a huge challenge. You already have a job. You just want to read about cricket. Well, that is what the best of cricket is currently doing. They go out daily to find the newest cricket coverage and the best stories from any publication in the world. And when they can't discover what they want, they also hire some of the best writers to produce their own great stories. You can get the best of cricket via their website or on WhatsApp. They find cricket's best stories and give them to you every day. Ben says, do we need a new name for cricket tournaments given that they are rigged and not every team is treated equally and therefore doesn't have the same level playing field to compete in? Entertainment in the form of cricket or cricket-based entertainment. So, Ben, this has always been the case. In 1975, it was the first men's cricket tournament. I don't know as much about the women's, but I would have thought the women's was an invitational. The men's tournament in 1975 there was no qualifications involved. They essentially made a team up in East Africa to play and didn't invite some of the good European sides like Netherlands, Denmark. Was there someone else? It's Ireland or Scotland, perhaps, I'm not sure. At that stage. So we've always done this. The first Champions Trophy, the qualifying game beforehand to get into the tournament, they made two teams play off, Zimbabwe versus New Zealand. The actual teams who should have done it based on rankings, I think, at that stage, which should have been Zimbabwe and England. But the Bangladesh authorities didn't want England to miss out on that tournament. First Champions Trophy, the first World Cup. We've been doing it for so long that the people who run cricket, I've been saying this for so long, Ben, if you go back through my work, that there are all these people going, oh, what's your proof there's corruption in cricket? And I was like, we openly rig the tournaments. The games are openly rigged so we can have certain situations. And for all those people who complain about India-Pakistan playing each other all the time, England and Australia play each other at virtually every tournament as well, right? Like, it's not just India-Pakistan. And it's not just, those sorts of situations that you get yourselves in. This is different than the West Indies one. I think the West Indies one was a poor, West Indies-America one was poor. From the ICC to do what they did. I understand why they do it from a financial reason and everything else, but it just looked bad. This one is different because I'm not sure that the Indian cricket team, with everything that's going on in the world, should be in Pakistan at the moment. Like, I'm I'm more than understanding that. I'm sure there were Indian players who had no issues with it, and there are other Indian players who might not have even played if that was the case. But that was never going to happen. Once you decide to have that in Pakistan, you have to accept that. But overall, the way that we do things is just bad, right? Like, you know, the Asia Cup, I know that's the third biggest tournament, I suppose, or the fourth biggest, depending on how you look at it, tournament. But again, openly doing stuff that is just like, yeah. But we've unfortunately been doing it in cricket for a long time, and it's potentially opened the floodgates for these kinds of things. It's not going away now. MF Jim says, has Australia finally gotten a moral victory over England? There wasn't a trace of Bazball in the game against Australia's B team of pacers, who also outperformed England's pace attack. Was this also put some fear into England that Archer and Wood aren't a working combination for the Ashes? I wouldn't worry about it from the Ashes. They're not going to bowl on too many Pakistani wickets during the Ashes, maybe. Is it a moral victory for Australia? Yeah, I think they would take that. England has already started to say we played well enough to win the game. Was that what Liam Livingstone said? And I think Dew has to be factored in, but they also have to be, and now we know that Cass was injured, right? So when we thought he was, so that's good. So at least that comes back. I don't think England played terribly. I just don't think they're as good a side as Australia. And Australia just had more weapons and got the slightly better of the conditions. But yeah, England were trying to change the style that they played because the Bazball style that they'd be playing against India hadn't been. But yeah, I don't think it means much for the Ashes. Sam says, Ireland tour of Zimbabwe or Bahrain tour of Indonesia? Which would you rather be watching than the Champions Trophy? Bahrain tour of Indonesia. Well, I probably will be watching Ireland's tour of Zimbabwe later. I've been watching a lot of Zimbabwe cricket recently. When they put it on a place that you can friggin' see it, my God, they make it hard to see at times. But, you know, I watch quite a bit of cricket from Zimbabwe. Probably, what, Zimbabwe, Canada, America, Namibia are three of the better time zones for me to watch cricket. So, and I'm a big fan of the Zimbabwean team, so I'll probably watch that one. I didn't know Bahrain was touring Indonesia. I don't know much about Bahrain or Indonesia, so now you've got me interested. It's not whether I'd be rather watching it than the Champions Trophy. I'm watching some of the best teams in the world go up against each other. I've got no problem with the Champions Trophy. I wish the games were better. But you've got the Women's Premier League on as well. There is other cricket on if you don't want to watch the Champions Trophy. There's almost always cricket on. Panda Cyborg says, listening to ex-players on commentary can be at times be a little painful. While on commentary yourself, have you ever had a moment where the person you're on comms with has said something just entirely factually wrong? How would you deal with it, particularly if the person on question is a famous ex-player? When I was hired at TalkSport, it was largely to fact-check people, right? And I'll be honest, I've been lucky. Darren Goff and Steve Harmison really do their homework, right? And I probably commentated with them the most. Mark Butcher's just, other than being a friend of mine, he's just a clever guy. Like, he'd be a clever guy if he wasn't a cricketer. He's a clever guy for a cricketer, I suppose is what I'm trying to say. Like, so again, you've got, you know, fairly smart people. Look, there are certainly things, it depends on the moment and what it is. Because sometimes when someone says something wrong, it gives you the chance to have a cool little discussion about it. Sometimes you don't have time. And so you can just question it, but move on. And sometimes you're like, are you sure? And then you put your case out. So it really depends on what you're trying to do and who the person is and what your relationship with them. If Goffey says something that's wrong, he knows I'm going to come back. Like, I shouldn't say that. Like, if Goffey says something and I come back, he'll know that I will have done my research, right? So then if he's positive, he'll go with me. And if he's not, he'll hedge a little bit. Absolutely fine. Harmy doesn't mind being called wrong. And if Harmy doesn't know something or whatever, and Harmy will then add to the conversation. But there are other people you don't, sometimes you'll get an ex-player who's not particularly comfortable on mic. Questioning them can kind of, for the rest of their stint, can really, really screw them up. Correcting them as well can cause an issue. But cricket commentary is a conversation. And remember, I do radio, so it is a little bit different on TV. I don't know the dynamics as much on TV. But I do radio, and my job is to get a conversation. So if someone has said something I don't agree with, that's kind of perfect, right? Like, great. Now let me say this, this, and this. And sometimes I'll be like, no, you're right. What I meant was there. But they've said something? I've said something, and now they're saying something. That is a conversation. So even if they didn't quite get their words out correctly the first time, we still have the ability to go through it. The other thing that was worth remembering is that as cricket fans, we sometimes get a little bit too in our own head. It's like, they've said something wrong. You know, this podcast goes for, what, an hour and 10. I'm on my own. How many factual things will I get wrong at this time? And not just factual things. Sometimes it will be simple misspeaking, right? There's a guy who used to critique my podcast and he would come back and I was like, when you can do an hour and 10 on your own without a mistake and make it entertaining, I will come and listen to your podcast, right? You have to accept that at times I'm going to slightly missay things. I'm getting my words in the wrong order. You know, all those sorts of things happen. And again, the players do that, right? You're on for half an hour. The cricket commentary is a very, it's a very rhythm-based thing. So you are aware. So you guys won't see this, of course, or won't understand this, but you're listening on the radio and the summarizer is trying to get their words out in a rhythm that will allow for the ball by baller to take over. So sometimes you speed up what you're saying and sometimes you slow it down. And so that's when mistakes can come in even more so. And you might say the wrong thing. So you should never be like, well, that's wrong. Because that doesn't start a conversation. That will just make them defensive, right? And the same is if they said it to me. But if they say, well, that's interesting because, and or they go, are you sure? Because I think this, that is a conversation. And that's what cricket commentary is at its best. Amit says, being a leg spinner yourself, can you explain how leg spinners increase or vary their speeds while having the same number of revolutions on the ball? Technically, why is it very hard to do? Like Kuldeep completely changed his bowler when he was able to bowl quicker with the same revs and now seems off when his pace has decreased. You can't actually keep the same revs on the ball as your pace increases. All right? Like at a certain point, the revs slow down the ball. So that doesn't quite follow. But what you're talking about is how can a leg spinner still get a lot of revs on the ball by bowling quicker. So my big problem was that I bowled with a front-on action, Amit, right? Because Mushtaq Ahmed was my hero and he had a bit of a front-on action. And that was the one that kind of, that worked best for me. When you bowl with a front-on action, you can only impart so many revs on the ball. So when I bowled quicker, what would happen is I wouldn't get the same amount of revolutions on the ball, or it would just slow. If I put the same amount of revolutions on, it would slow down so that I was bowling at my other speed anyway, right? So it was almost like a catch 22. So a couple of years ago, I know a lot more about biomechanics and everything. I was like, okay, I'm going to try bowling side on. And when I bowled side on, and it's basically, I think Richie Beno is the best one. He sort of said, you look through between your shoulder and your hand. And you come through, the revolutions don't come from your hand as much then, but from your entire body, right? And this is why I was talking about Shadab Khan on a video a while back. He's not getting the revolutions on his body anymore. So he's having to do all the work with his hand, which naturally slows you down a little bit, right? When you start to get the revolutions there, you can get the same, you can get more revolutions on the ball, right? And then you can bowl faster. So I'm still getting less revolutions than I would be if I bowled slower with the exact same action, but I can get enough revolutions that I get side spin on the ball at a higher pace. And that is kind of what Kuldeep did. He made some small technical changes. I think his was to his run up and maybe his front arm, if I remember correctly, but I'd have to go back and have a look, which allowed him to get a similar amount of revolutions while bowling faster. But what he wasn't doing was just bowling faster with the same action. He was changing his entire action to do that. And I've noticed that, like, in doing that, I've gone from being a slow leg spinner to a fast leg spinner. And I actually spin the ball almost exactly the same as I did with my old action, but at a lot quicker. Like, I'd probably be, I don't know, 5 or 10 kilometers quicker than I used to bowl my leg spin. And people don't use their feet to me anymore. I mean, I do play in England, so there is an element of that. But that people can't use their feet to me anymore because I'm so fast. I can trap people for LBWs a lot easier. You know, all those things have happened. But I'm getting exactly the same amount of spin as I did before, but just faster. But what it's just because of the entire method that I have changed. So the idea of telling a spinner to bowl faster doesn't work outside of on spinning wickets as they're crumbling or those sorts of things. But in general, it doesn't work because when you bowl faster, you just get less revolutions on the ball. But if you change your action and you, you know, perfect your action, then you have the ability to do that. MFGM says, Shaheen has looked floaty out of the hand for a while now. Is it his pace falling? Is it his pace falling away a bit, or is he just overused as a teenager and the early wear and tear is showing? He's got a knee injury. I think it's as simple as that. I don't think he gets the same power through the crease as he used to, and he hasn't been the same bowler since that knee injury. The Tooth says, Sachin and Smith both played the channel ball to leg side as a strike rotating shot. Sachin had the straight drive as well. We know Bradman considered his technique to be similar to Sachin's. Do you think having these shots has some connections to the level of test batting, or is it a coincidence? Yeah, Sachin probably played the off-stump ball more to the leg side, whereas obviously Smith, and then Sachin was probably more playing that ball to mid-wicket-ish, whereas Smith is taking the ball from outside of stump and hitting it to backward square leg or square leg. So it's different, but the same. Kevin Peterson, Victor Trumper, Viv Richards, Don Bradman. So we've had quite a few players with that method, and players beneath their talent level as well, do that before. I don't think, I've had this argument with Mike Atherton once. I don't think you can be a great test batter without conquering the channel. And it's slightly different now because it's probably the top of off now. But traditionally, it was just outside off stump. It doesn't matter how you do it. So Kane Williamson and Rahul Dravid did it by opening their face and running the ball along the ground to third, gully, backward point. Joe Root does it by going between what? Cover point and backward point. BJ Watling did it by just defending, right? So it doesn't really matter what you do, but if you don't conquer that section, you're not going to be a top level test batter, right? And so you have to find a repeatable method for you. I don't think I would take Sachin out of that a little bit, because I don't think he played across the line in the same way that Smith and Viv and KP and Bradman did. But it's the same kind of thing of how you handle that channel just outside off stump. You know, Virat Kohli was going and meeting the ball and driving it, right, on the up. You know, all the different great players, when you go through, they have slightly different methods of how they handle that one ball. And it's kind of the difference between surviving and not surviving consistently in test cricket. Because in first-class cricket, either the balls are put in that same area but are slower, so it's easier to handle it, or they're not put in there as much, right? The level of bowling goes up quite substantially from first class cricket to test cricket. And there's no drop off. In first class cricket, you can kind of cheat it by getting to 30 or 40, and then the first change and the second change, all of that. There's two spinners on, but chances are you won't be, all you need to do is find a way to get singles off the good spinner so you can get to the other end. Like, there's always ways of cheating in test cricket. It's very rare that you get the opportunity to cash in from that sort of stuff. So that, for me, is the essence of it, you know, and there's a whole chapter in my book about essentially how to play that era. And I think Chris Rogers, when I talked to him, he was the best player talking that I've ever talked to about this, where he was just like, in test cricket, that is batting, right? Like, if you take the spin out of it and you just talk about seam, that is batting. How you handle that basically tells you what your ceiling is and how you're going to end up as a player. And we were talking specifically a lot about David Warner, and he was sort of saying, you know, Warner with that sort of back foot choppy shot meant that it was very hard to bowl just outside off stump to him without bowling really, really full. And if you bowled full, he was really quick to get forward and get away. And if you bowled back, and for most of Warner's career, back of the length was the more normal thing, he could play this weird tennis ball-y shot, especially in Australia and South Africa, and it took away your ability to just bowl to him. That's what the best players do. And it doesn't matter where that ball goes, Tooth, right? There's nothing more special in Sachin, Smith, and Bradman than there is in Gavaskar, Hutton, Lara, right? From that point of view, even if they hit the ball more in to where they want to hit it, right? It's the same thing. The difference is as you get up to that sort of Sachin, Lara, and probably Smith, although Smith is a bit more one-dimensional, but once you get up to that sort of Sachin, Lara level, you probably also have the ability to hit the ball anywhere you want. And with Sachin, he would probably go, okay, well, a normal player will hit this to mid-on or mid-off, so I can hit this to mid-wicket. Whereas Lara, is like, a normal player will hit this to mid on and mid off. I can hit this to backward point or fine leg. And so those are the sorts of decisions that those players are making. You know, AB de Villiers is a perfect example of that, of not quite on the level of those guys overall, but especially against fast bowling, having that ability to be able to do that means, where do you bowl to AB de Villiers? So he's more in that Lara area where he can kind of hit it anywhere, whereas then you have the sort of more traditionalist guys who are going to just stuff with the field a little bit, like Sachin, like Kane Williamson, like Root. And then you have the drag to leg guys who are like, well, they're never going to be able to have enough fielders on the leg side to stop me from scoring. And that's your Viv Richards, Steve Smith, Kevin Peterson type players. Ian says, there was a rich history of top quality players pitching up in English leagues. Alan Donald, 106 wickets, just under 11 for Rishton. Imagine turning up in a league cricket and facing Alan Donald. Michael Holding played for the same club years earlier. If you're a club captain, when a bowler so far above that level arrives, how do you tell your players to try play them? There's a great story. Because there's so many great stories of what you're talking about. And I suppose Scott Oliver has told some, he's probably like the modern day version of that. But, you know, there was a rich history of cricket writers writing about this because there's some incredible stuff. You know, Garfield Sobers, Basil Dolavira, like just dominating, right? But there's a great story of someone who, and I can't remember the West Indian bowler. I thought it was Wes Hall, but it might not have been. It might have been Kirtley or Courtney. It might have been that late, or it might have been someone in the middle. Anyway, someone made 100 against the West Indies and was a club legend, against the West Indies fast bowler and was a club legend. And this writer had heard about it for years and went back and interviewed everyone. And it turned out that he didn't score a single run in front of square. And basically, he just kept edging the ball past the slips or over the slips. And that's how he made his 100. Awesome. Like, it made the story even better, right? That, you know, this guy had been holding onto this 100 all the way through, and it turned out it was the RC's 100 of all time in his life. But he still owned that 100. Like, you know, now someone's writing about it, which is even better. There's not much you can do. I mean, you can say to players, shorten your back lift. I've never found it successful to shorten my back lift. When I play guys who are a bit too fast for me, I've shot my back lift 100 times and I've never really made it work. Some people can do it. It's a very hard thing to tell a club player to do that if they've never tried it before. But shortening your back lift is the best thing if you're going up against a bowler that's that much better than you. But essentially what you were looking for is to find a method, right? And so it doesn't really matter what that method is. But there is a chance of, against that bowler, there might be something within their bowling that allows you to stay in. Maybe not score off them, but stay in. That is probably what I would say to people, is try and work out how they are trying to get you out. And is there a way to stop them from that? So that at the very least, they have to go to B or to C. I've probably told this story before, but my club, Coburg, played against Mick Lewis, who ended up coaching Coburg years later. But we played against Mick Lewis just as he was getting picked for Victoria. And so he was playing club cricket and bowling at 90 miles an hour, which is nuts. And then he played against us. And so we were like, we had some very good players in our team. We had a second 11 player who was opening in that game because it was like a warm-up for the season. Mick Lewis knew he was going to play for Victoria that year. Like that was, he might have even already been in the squad. Like he was fast-tracked so much. And so you had this situation where he was firing. This game clearly meant a lot to him. And he got in a war of words with this guy who just wasn't good enough, right? And just ends up peppering him and saying things like, I'm not going to try and get you out. I'm just going to try and hit you as much as possible. And I remember being there and being very happy I wasn't batting, because how would I have faced Mick Lewis? And Mick Lewis got like 2 for 20 off 8-10 overs, whatever it was that day. And our team actually went on to make a pretty decent total. I think we might have still just lost the game in the end. But he didn't take like 5 for 10, right? Like he could have. And there are a couple of players who could play him, and there are a couple of players who couldn't play him. I'm not saying you should take as many balls on the chest as my friend did, because my memory of him was he was covered in bruises. But getting into that kind of, you know, idea, like let's say you're not a very good player and you're going up against an opposition fast bowler. Sid Barnes used to do this a lot. Sid Barnes was a brilliant player when the ball was on his stumps, and he would, to get back to the previous question, would work the ball to the leg side. And Sid Barnes would goad bowlers in by saying, "You're not fast enough to bowl me," so that they would try and bowl more and more at his stumps. And of course, that's what he wanted. There are little things that you can do. You know, I remember one thing that I was taught really early on was if you're hit by a fast bowler, pick the ball up and throw it back and go, "Is that the best you can do, champ?" Right? And I got hit once a bunch of times from a guy who just forgot to get me out, right? And he just kept bowling fast and short at me. And I was almost like a karate, person. I was tensing my body beforehand because I wasn't worried about the stumps. The same with, I had a leg spinner who I couldn't play very well. And I just told him he wouldn't get me out with a wrong-un. Like, there are little things that you can do to upset a bowler's plan or rhythm or anything else. But yeah, quite often against fast bowling, it's just taking it on the body. James says, "I'm currently watching a foolish baseball video on pitchers punching solid objects and breaking their pitching hands." What are some of your favorite, foolish baseball? I haven't watched their videos for a while, but they're great. What do you say, favorite stories of injuries incurred by cricket players? Well, Brad Hodge injuring his back, putting his trousers on has to be one of the greatest ones ever. Shout out, Hodgie. I've got a feeling that Trevor Franklin, on two successive tours of England, injured himself. Well, first time I think he was hit by a bowler and broke his arm, but I reckon he then was run over by the luggage truck at the airport and broke his leg. I think I'm right in saying that, which has got to be one of the more bizarre ones. Jimmy Adams was allegedly attacked by one of his teammates on a plane and stabbed through the hand. Shout out to Jimmy Adams if he's watching as well. Don't know why I'm only remembering people that I know doing weird stuff. Who was it who was it Alex Carey on wearing spikes on a shiny floor in, I want to say Pakistan? Was it in Pakistan? Anyone in the world, and so many cricket grounds around the world have these incredibly like hard marble type floors. And it's like, they do not work very well with cricket spikes. There's a lot of stories of people hurting themselves that way. I'm trying to think of some others. Oh, and of course, Shoaib Akhtar and the genital warts, allegedly. Richard says, "Suppose England beat Bangladesh and squeaked into the quarterfinals in the 2015 World Cup before being destroyed by India. Other than not giving you a story for double century," yeah, it would have been annoying. "How does this change cricket for the next few years? Do England decide to coast on making the quarters and not change the way they play? How does that affect the way that all teams play then?" I mean, naturally, we were going to score quicker anyway without England, because that was already happening, because the T20 boom was coming through. I think the big difference is that Morgan isn't given carte blanche to do whatever he wants, right? So I think that changes English cricket, and therefore we have this more sort of slow and steady move. But I think players like Jaiswal and Head and Abhishek Sharma and Heinrich Klassen and I think they were coming naturally. So there is a bit of a movement there. But yes, I think you then don't get teams trying to imitate England, probably. And they probably would have done it. They would have done what Morgan wanted, but in a less wholehearted way, would be my guess. So I don't think people would have imitated England in the same way. So I think you're probably right. Rob says, "There are too many S-tier players for just one 11. So who are in your two teams for the greatest of all time? Teams need to be balanced. This might be a quick picks episode, but give us a sneak peek. So too many S-tier players for just one 11. So who are in your two teams?" Oh, okay. I haven't actually made like a great 11 of all time. So I suppose you would have what? Hobbs and Hutton, Bradman, Tendulkar, Lara, Sobers. That gives you an all-rounder, doesn't it? Wicketkeeper just depends on whether you want a great keeper or a great batter. But let's just keep it simple and do the batting for now and do Gilchrist. Les Ames or Gilchrist, I suppose, are the easy ones there. That's got us to seven players. So then you're looking at, I would probably have Warne, McGrath, maybe, I was going to say Hadley, but Warne, I want a fast bowler if I have. If I've already got Sobers and I've already got McGrath, I probably want Garner. And you could also put Imran, I suppose, in there as well, and that gives you everyone. So then in the other team, you would then have Hadley. If we start at the openers again, you would have Gavaskar. You'd have Gavaskar, and who would be the next opener? Probably need an attacking one, maybe Greenidge. So Gavaskar and Greenidge at first drop. Oh, I'm trying to think of where everyone bats now off the top of my head. At first drop, you'd have Richards, maybe, I think. Then you would have Smith. And who do you want at number five in that side? Can we have fun with it and put Kumar at number five and make him keep? And then I've got Imran and Sobers in my other side. So can I have both of them, Dev Hadley, throughout that middle, Murali, Akram, and I don't know if I'm missing anyone else. Marshall. I could probably pick Marshall on the other side as well. I might have forgotten him. But yeah, off the top of my head. And they could, if you ask me in 5 minutes' time, I would probably disagree with all of that. But very much off the top of my head, and I'd like to apologize to all the very good players I probably missed and should have put in. Oh, maybe I'd have, yeah, because of Callis. You'd have to fit Callis in. So I might drop Dev for Callis and then back Callis at five, Kumar at six, Botham at seven. I think that more or less works as a side. I had Murali in, didn't I? I don't have a second spinner in that side, which is a bit annoying. Anyway, let's have a quick break here. And then after, more Wagon Wheel. And that is why Nasser Hussain decided to bowl first at the Gabba. And this all, of course, reminds me of Hit Wicket, which is a mobile cricket strategy game that is all about making those tough decisions. Who do you want to send in as an opener when the asking rate is climbing? Do you go for the big hitter or the steady accumulator? Me, I like to throw in someone a little bit unorthodox, a bit of a wild card like the general that keeps the opposition guessing. And what about the bowling attack? Do you unleash your express pace early or hold back for the death overs? I'm always tempted to bring on a mystery spinner in the middle overs and just try and break a partnership. Hit Wicket puts you in the captain's chair. You draft the squad and select the batting order and even decide when to use those game-changing abilities. Do you burn your 2x ability to chase down a big total or save it for a critical moment later on? It's strategic, it's addictive, and it's more nerve-wracking than facing a Shoaib Akhtar bouncer. Give it a go. Download Hit Wicket and see if you've got the tactical nous to win. All right, welcome back. Bloody Bugger says, is it horticulturally possible to create a pitch which not only turns a lot but also has good pace and bounce? Well, I mean, the Gabba used to have good pace and bounce and Warne used to spin it, but I suppose Warne could spin the ball anywhere. Jimenez is probably a bit in better place to talk to about this, but generally you need friction in order to get spin, and friction slows the ball down would be my guess. So bounce, yes. Ace, no, would be my guess. So, there are wickets that probably have a combination of all three, but, you know, if you look at Australia, the pitch that had the most spin historically was the SCG, and it wasn't particular, it was probably one of the slower surfaces and one of the lower surfaces. Still probably higher than most countries, but not high bounce for Australia. Satsbro says, should England have gambled on a second spinner for the Champions Trophy? Wouldn't Archer strike bowlers, but they can't contain at the death, or have they given up on developing spinners for ODIs? I think they went with their strength, Satchmo. And I'm not going to fault his side for doing that, because Liam Dawson is probably not going to win them the Champions Trophy. Although the way he's bowling in recent times, he might. I think that I would have re-looked at Liam Dawson based on having watched him bowl over the last year and a half. But I'm not sure he wins you the Champions Trophy. Wood and Archer, they've gone for all strike bowlers at the moment, but that's as I said from one of the earlier answers, I'm not sure that they have like good containing bowlers in England coming up. And as far as they're not giving up on developing spinners, they still, you know, they think Rayan Ahmed, obviously there's about three or four guys coming through. Who's the guy that played in the Big Bash? Is it Jaffa Ali? I think he follows me on Instagram. Jaffa Chohan. Is that the one I'm thinking of? 22-year-old leg spinner? That sounds like him. you know, he's someone that they've got their eye on. There's about, what, two or three others that I've heard about as well coming through that they really like. They're not quite there yet, right? Rehan Ahmed, I don't think they can get 10 overs a game out of him unless it's absolutely ragging or the other team's not very good, right? And the others probably just aren't there. I might have been tempted to go with Liam Dawson. I wonder if Liam Dawson was still batting like the old Liam Dawson, I think they just automatically would have picked him. And maybe if Samet Patel in his peak, they probably would have picked him. But Australia only have one frontline spinner as well. Like, you know, and chances are South Africa willing to use one all the way through the tournament. Amit says, it has been known, in fact, that you are good friends with Rahul Dravid and he rates you highly. Mentions me on his website. It's still one of the weirder things in my life. Have you guys ever discussed the possibility of working together for a cricket team? No. He wanted someone who was focusing more on analytics for test stuff when I was becoming an analyst. I think they already he already had someone coming through. And also, I would have been a very hard sell to the BCCI. I haven't talked to him about Rajasthan, to be honest. So I don't know if there's ever a possibility there in the future. Obviously, I've been, you know, linked to Rajasthan in other ways before, had chats with Manoj and about other positions within the team. I think they kind of have people. So unless Rahul Dravid needed me, I don't know if that would be a position. I'm not a big hit your friends up for jobs sort of person. At the moment, I'm having to email a bunch of famous people who are friends of mine to ask them to say something nice about me, about my book. And I absolutely hate it. So I could never imagine contacting someone who I was close friends with and asking. But if we had a conversation where it kind of naturally went that way, then that might be a little bit different. But, you know, I've got lots of friends who are coaches and general managers and all sorts of things. I'd just rather that they came to me rather than the other way around. And most of my jobs have been that way. Like Scotland came to me, St. Lucia came to me, Melbourne Stars came to me. I could have pressed for some of those positions, but because I had relationships with those people, I kind of didn't. That's just how I am. It's, you know, there are other people out there who are much better at marketing. I'm very good at marketing my work. I'm not very good at marketing me. And I just don't feel comfortable with it. It's just not my thing. You know, it's called the Good Areas Network. Because I didn't like it being called Jared. I didn't ever wanted it to be called Jared Kimber, but Aria, who used to help run everything around here, was like, you have to call it Jared Kimber to start with. And he was probably right. So, so that's the first part of it. We've never really chatted that I can remember. He sought me out for stuff. The same way that I, occasionally will say, I'm, you know, trying to do this thing. What do you think? If he offered me a work as an analyst consultant, would I consider it? Yes, because I respect him a lot. And I wouldn't just consider it because he's a friend. I would consider it because he listens and he's intellectually curious, right? The people that I've worked with, Stephen Fleming, Trent Woodhill, who I didn't know Fleming particularly well beforehand, but I obviously knew Trent quite well. Who's the other two that I just said? Brad Hodge, Muhammad Khan at St. Lucia, and at Scotland, Shane Berger and Steve Smith, who was the guy who got me involved, not that Steve Smith. They were intellectually curious and they wanted to know what I did and they wanted to know how I could help them. So it made sense to accept that job. I've been offered jobs in other teams and other leagues, major teams and smaller teams, where I'm like, there's no point me taking this job on because these people aren't going to listen to me. And that's not like arrogance or anything. It's just a waste of my time and their money, right? Like I could be off doing something else. I don't like to do stuff unless I'm useful. Like I've been offered analyst jobs in veteran leagues and for good money. And I've said no, because it's what the hell am I going to be telling veteran players about analysis? They don't even need me there. I don't even understand what I'm doing in those positions, right? Like it's such a weird thing to be offered. So I haven't really worried about that sort of stuff. So someone like Rahul Dravid would do it. It changes the relationship though. Like I didn't know Brad Hodge beforehand. So that's different. I didn't know Shane Berger beforehand, But I did know Trent Woodhill beforehand, and it's changed our relationship a little bit. Not in a bad way, right? But you have, anytime you work for someone or under someone or with someone, it changes the relationship a little bit. But I think me and Rail Driver are quite open and honest with each other when we don't chat a lot or anything. It's not, you know, it's more when we bump into each other around that we're more likely to be chatting to each other. But we're very open when we chat to each other. So I think that would, anyone who I have that kind of relationship with, you know, Darren Goff asked me to come in at Yorkshire. I didn't really want to go to Yorkshire at that time. You know, he might still ask me to come in at in the PSL, although I think he probably has people now. But if he did, I have a really good working relationship with Darren Goff, right? So it would change, and I have to then consider what it's like to work for him rather than just be someone who works together with him. But he listens to me, and we have a good conversation, and I know what kind of things he wants to hear, if that makes sense, that will jog him. So in some ways, it's a better start than when I had to work with Brad Hodge, when me and Brad Hodge had to learn how to work together because he didn't know who I was, right? Even Shane Berger, when I worked at Scotland, me and Shane Berger had actually spent a bit of time together because we were supposed to be working together for the Edinburgh Rocks. So he understood how I worked and we understood that we had a good dynamic. So that's all I'm looking for, right? I mean, and now I'm not as looking for analyst jobs, although certainly in the IPL, I'd be more interested in that. But I want my position to be slightly different than just as an analyst. So it would also depend on the job and the position and the pay and everything else. But also with the way that Good Areas is going, I have to be very careful that I protect what we have built here, right? So I don't want to give up something that is huge, right? You know, we have, I don't know, 250,000 followers across, oh, it's probably more than that. It's probably 300,000 subscribers across all the different places we're in, right? Right at the time when we're doing really well, and it's, you know, the previous month when there wasn't a World Cup on and the BGT had finished, after that we got like 2.7 million views over a month long period. We've never had anything like that happen before. So we have to, as a business, I have to make decisions as a business. You know, there are things that Bayram can do and Estelle can do and I can find others, but whether they can do everything, cover everything that I cover, and whether the site would continue to grow at the same rate if Jared is not part of it. So there is heaps of different things, but I would take a conversation with, and not just with Wild Driver. As I said, you could throw Darren Goff in. If John Buchanan got a job in cricket, I'd love to talk to him. If Mike Hessen reached out, like someone like him, I'd be really interested in working with. I'm trying to think who else I've talked to. You know, some of the other, you know, Ryan Tentascata, who I worked with, Jay Dernbach, Gareth Batty, you know, people that I've worked with and I've got a relationship with. I'd be very interested in working with some of them, right? But it has to be the right job at the right time, regardless of my friendship or anything else. Ben says, should there be a limit on how soon after a franchise tournament has ended that a player can join another one? I appreciate we're into the nobody runs cricket argument here. Yes. So I think what they're trying to do now is make sure that once you sign up for one tournament, you can't play in another one. But the problem is we are into the nobody runs cricket and it's a little bit tough. I think all the leagues, it's a bit like there was a few years ago when there was, I think the CPL was one of the leagues that was pioneering this, but I could be wrong, was that your money was going to be like in a mortgage. Like when you buy a house, your money was going to be kept so by the owners beforehand and then doled out directly then by the cricket, the league, right? But the reason that it's very hard for the CPL to do that is the other leagues don't do that, right? And so it really needs to be, everyone needs to be on board with these sorts of things. But yes, that we have to stop this from happening. Without being in a situation where it restricts the player's ability to earn. And I think it's more than fair enough to say, you have signed up for this tournament, you have made this decision to play for this tournament, and it goes from this date to this date. You cannot play for any other tournaments during that time. That would be what a common sense, sensible sport would do. Let's see what we do. Panda Cyborg says, hypothetical selection question. You have to pick one of two bowlers to lock into your test team's lineup for the next 10 years. Assume that both bowlers are physically identical. Bowler A will average exactly 28 every year of his career. Bowler B will average 30 for 2 years, 20 for 3 years, and 32 for 5 years, leaving him with an average of 28. Who is the better pick over the 10 years? 32 over 5 years compared to 28 every single year. So he's going to average 20 for 3 years. I probably would pick Bowler B based on the fact that the opposition is probably more terrified of Bowler B than Bowler A. So I don't know what Peter Siddle's record is compared to Mitchell Johnson's, but would they not have these kinds of numbers? And as good as Peter Siddle was, his top end never terrified anyone. And so the impact of having a strike bowler, I'm willing to carry them in their lesser years, knowing that teams are still going to be terrified of them. So Peter Siddle averages 30.66. So he's a little bit behind Mitchell Johnson, isn't he? Who's what? Is he 28? He's 28.4. Okay. So there's not a huge amount of difference between them, right? So even when Siddle was bowling well, teams feared Mitchell Johnson more. And so, and I know part of that is just the extra pace and the left armness and everything else. But I do think there is an element there that I want the opposition to be a little bit more worried about us coming in. Whereas a 28 average bowler who's just, I'm thinking of them as being more, they're more consistent with what they do. Everyone knows what they're going to do. Whereas you don't know what the other guy's going to do because his career goes up and down, would be my guess. MF Jim says, as an aside to my Sheen question, what pace is considered bad for a bowler? I remember Ollie Robertson bowling at 120 in the test and thinking it just wasn't fast enough. There isn't a pace that's bad for a bowler, but you have, because it's about lateral movement as well, right? So if you are Muhammad Asif or Ollie Robertson or Muhammad Abbas or Vernon Philander, and you can get more sideways movement than anyone else, Stuart Clarke, you can get more sideways movement than anyone else, and you can do that at 128 kilometers an hour. That is as hard to play, right, consistently, as someone bowling dead straight at 155 kilometers an hour, right? That's why those bowlers all have really good records. What the problem is when you go under your threshold for that thing. So if your unwritten Kia can't bowl at 138 kilometers an hour, whereas if Ollie Robinson bowled at 138 kilometers an hour and did what he did, he'd be the best bowler in the world, right? So it's really about what your skills are. Unwritten or Kia needs to be 144 to 148 minimum consistently because he doesn't get a lot of sideways movement. Shannon Gabriel doesn't get a lot of... I think Shannon Gabriel, I think this was Crickfus told me, he had the least amount of sideways movement in the world for a long period of time. But he actually was a really good bowler. And that's because he hit the pitch really hard and he was fast. So it's not, there is no magic speed that you are looking for. You can, Glenn McGrath slowed down and he was still a really effective bowler. He's nowhere near as quick as when he was younger. Curtly Ambrose slowed down, right? They were still really, really effective. So it's really about, are you not getting as much sideways movement? Are you, I don't know, let's say your action has changed. You're not as tall, you know, tall as you used to be. You fall over a little bit at the crease, whatever that may be. It's, all those things are as important as pace, but they aren't flashed up on the screen. Richard says, is this the worst Australian bowling attack at arguably a major tournament since the 1980s? Maybe the 2014 T20 World Cup. So what was that? Xavier Doherty, Shane Watson. Oh, no, I didn't do 2014. I can't remember who Australia's team was. 2014 T20 World Cup Australia squad. Was that Coulter Nile? Bales was still captain, wasn't he? So yeah, Coulter Nile, Faulkner was still okay then though, was he? Still had a knee. Hogg was still okay then. I mean, on paper, that's a way better bowling attack than this. 1979 World Cup Australia, because they didn't pick, Packer players, did they? So Australia's bowling attack was Hogg, Hurst, Dimmick, Porter, Cozier in the Canada game. That's just the first one that's come up. So just go through this. Hogg got two overs against Canada and went for 26 runs, Rodney Watt. Not a particularly good one-day bowler, was he? he was fine, but probably a better test bowler, I would have thought. All things considered, Alan Hurst. Yeah, that's a pretty one. So 79's bad. 83 has Tomo and Lily, doesn't it? So, no. And 86, 87 has the slow ball revolution, right? So it's not them. And then you're looking at some of the other Champions Trophy squads. I would have thought, yeah, I mean, this feels like the worst one since 79, but I'd have to go through it, Rudra, to be 100% sure. Maybe if they make the finals, that could be a video, because I've been thinking about it. Bloody says, for fast bowling, does hitting the deck hard to get more bounce reduce swing in the air? Is it possible to do both? So hitting the deck means you're going straighter into more directly into the surface. Swing needs to be floated up. So that's why you don't get swing when you bowl short. So if you're hitting the deck, you are taking the swing away almost automatically every time, Bloody. So yes, that is the case. Let's have one more quick ad break here. And then after the break, we will be back with... I almost played the backometer, which is just in my thing here. But after the break, we'll be back with more of the show and questions from the Super Chats. A test happens when you're asleep. Where do you find the best match report? A cricketer's backstory is meticulously crafted by a great writer. But it's a day you're not on social media, and so you miss out. We all do this. It becomes almost a full-time job to follow the sport you love. But there is a solution. The emailer Best of Cricket can tell you what the main stories are and the best articles every single day. And when they can't find them, they even write their own. Now, instead of trudging through Twitter or Blue Sky, you can just wait for the Best of Cricket to email or WhatsApp the greatest cricket stories straight to you. Subscribe to Best of Cricket today. All right, plenty of super chats, in fact, here on the Wagon Wheel. Ikan says, what shot reveals the batter's technique the most? It's a really good question. I kind of feel like it's a drive, because you footwork is involved and hands are involved, if that makes sense. If I'm looking at a player, that's probably the shot that is the first thing that I'm looking for. Are they bottom-handed? Are they top-handed? Do they move their feet? Do they get in line? Do they reach for the ball? Do they wait for it to come to them? So it's probably a drive. It's a good question. I'm not sure I have a great answer for it. Ikan says, how are anxious players taught to deal with doubts about themselves, or skills? How are the cocky ones taught to channel their confidence healthily? Look, it's a really good conversation. And it was something that when I was with St. Lucia, we talked about a lot, which is the best players are very even. They don't get too high. They don't get too low. It was a good day. It was a bad day, right? But they're sort of still somewhere in the middle on their emotions. It's something that I have noticed that I don't think there's a way to teach people, but you just have to try and get them in the right headspace of, these are the skills that you have. That's why these skills are transferable to this game. You now need to start believing in those skills, and once you do, the game will come down. They talk about it in the NBA quite a lot, of the game slows down. So when you're out there to begin with, everything's moving around really, really quickly, right? And it's the same when you see, sometimes you'll see a player make a debut in Test or in the IPL or, you know, anywhere, right? And you can see that they're just churning through really, really quickly in their head. What you want them to be able to do is be able to go, okay, so this guy's bowling to me and he's going to be able to bowl this. He's going to try and bowl this, and this is my scoring zones. And if they can't get to that, it doesn't work, right? And so you want them to be in a position to be like, you have been picked for this reason. We believe in your skill sets. We want you to do that. But until they've actually started to do it, it doesn't necessarily work. You know, in the book, The Art of Batting, available on the 8th of May, Mark Butcher sort of talks about being picked before he was ready and just knowing he shouldn't have been out there. They knew how talented Mark Butcher was, and eventually they were right. But he wasn't feeling that way when he was picked. And so it's very, very hard. The other side of things, the cocky ones, it's not so much that people are dragged in. It's that people understand that they have. It's all well and good being really confident in what you do, but you still have to play within the team's overall plan, and that you need to understand that if you are cocky, that the rest, everyone's going to try and drag you down a little bit, opposition and within the change room, is probably the way I would put that. Ikan again, if you're told by an optician to reduce your screen time, how would you go about it? Or has something like this happened? It would be hard as a writer. I don't generally write with a white background, which is something that I learned years ago, that puts a bit of a strain on your eyes. I suppose I've already tried to do things like that. I'm also long way away from my main screens, unless I'm on my laptop. But I'm a writer, so I'm probably just going to keep doing it. I think my eyesight's starting to go a little bit now. It could just be that I got a weird dishwasher cleaner the other day with incredibly small writing. But I wonder if my eyesight's starting to drop off a little bit more now. Perhaps I need to look at that. But I was tested only a couple of years ago and had, you know, nearly 20/20 vision. So it hasn't been something that I've worried about. I don't know, pick up more books. I'm reading a book at the moment on Danny Trejo. I love Danny Trejo. Hemant says, ODIs went from 60 overs to 50 overs. Is it high time to move from 50 overs to 40? They went from 60 overs. Do we have 65 overs as well? Do we have 55 overs? So they have bounced around a bit. 40 overs, one-day cricket is the best form of one-day cricket. You know, we need that meme where that guy sits down with a cup of coffee in front of him. It just is. I love 40. I came to the UK, and if you would have told me that 40-over cricket was like the best, I was like, well, it can't be the best. Otherwise, everyone would use it. And I spent about 3 months watching counter cricket, and I was like, so 40 overs is the best? It's too late, though, now. To move it to 40 overs now, I think, would cause issues with it's just too similar to T20 cricket. And so it doesn't have the important differential that you need it to have. Also, its main strength at the moment is the extra ad breaks. They would actually be taken away from that. So you're taking away 20 ad breaks there a month. But yeah, it's a better form of cricket, and we should have gone to it 20 years ago. Jack says, how to measure batters beyond runs and bowlers beyond wickets? Cummins to Maxwell, Leach to Stokes, Fernando to Pereira, Utapa to Rohit. Can't think of bowling equivalents. Yeah, so there are ways of doing this. For instance, the one that we've been looking at the most, and I don't know if Jimenez has been working on this as well, but he's in our group chatting to us about it. But I think the one that we want to look at is, and it's basically impact. So I don't know if it works in test cricket, although it might. But what we're really looking at is the chances of your team winning when you go out to bat compared to the chances of your team winning when you've been dismissed, for instance. If you're a bowler, what is the impact of you even coming on to bowl to the game in the chances to win? And how that goes. So you might, if you bowl a maiden, see, the bowling one's a bit trickier, because if you bowl a maiden, the next over you get a wicket, but you don't bowl the over after, we don't quite have it. But in a test match and probably in one-day cricket, it makes a little bit more sense. So Jimmy Anderson's bowling in a ODI. He bowls a maiden. Tim Bresnan comes on at the other end, takes a wicket, and then Jimmy Anderson bowls his next over for two runs. We know that the overall impact of Jimmy Anderson played some role in that wicket, would be our guess in this. So you're looking at it like an impact metric beyond runs and wickets and balls and all those sorts of things. In the way to do it in T20 and one day cricket is probably going away from the win predictors and either using Duckworth Lewis, or the other thing would be to use the betting markets. So there are win predictors now that I think I'm pretty safe in saying that they are almost 100% just the betting markets, and they are far more accurate than it was incredible how long it took for Australia to be favorite on, I think it was on CricViz and on the Crick Info match predictors, when the betting markets had them at like 160 or 150, like they were massively ahead in the game. And that's because the betting market was feeding in the dew. It was feeding in the fact that Brian Cass looked like he was injured. It's feeding in the fact that England couldn't stop a ball in the field, right? So how can a match predictor do that? It can't, right? So that if you can do that, I think there is something to be said for that. But that's still going to be warped by someone coming in and placing a $2 million, or not in that game, it would have been like a $4 million bet, right? Could still change it. So I don't know if it's 100% accurate. And, you know, if you're a really big better, one thing that you can do quite regularly is every time Sophie Eccleston or Rashid Khan or Noor Ahmed or Jasprit Bumrah or Partha Rana comes on to bowl, if you know they're going to bowl the next over and you put your bet on when the before anyone else has seen them take their cap off, you can actually make money because the betting markets are so smart. They're like, oh, okay, the best bowler's on bang. Right. And when it's one of those automatic bowlers, he's almost always good. Right. So you don't want to do it with Sophie Eccleston against Australia, but Sophie Eccleston against almost every other team. If you know she has the ball in her hand, it is worth backing her. Right. So there are issues within that. Duckworth Lewis has its own issues and everything else. But I think you get my overall point. Yes, there is a way of doing it, but we're not quite there yet, I don't believe. Shrikant says, averages can be misleading for mid-20th century players. Truman and Laker have average records in Australia. Were they indeed that much better than Benno and McKenzie? I haven't looked at bowlers, so I don't know. I would have thought that Truman was considerably better than McKenzie. Laker, I think Laker would have a great record if a player of his skill set had, you know, grown up now. Like, I'm not saying if you plucked him from then and brought him to now, because I don't know how you would play him in Asia, being that fast and being able to spin it and being that accurate. So I think those are both players with incredible skill sets. Richie Beno would have had a better record. It just took him, like most all-rounders, it took him forever to get good. And I think weirdly enough, I was looking this up the other day with Richie Beno. Some of the fact-checking on my book around the attacks that Ken Barrington went up against when he played against Australia. He went up against really weak attacks, but he did play against Davison and Beno. But when I looked at Beno, Beno was done by that point, I think, and really wasn't much. But if you look at Beno by year, only plays two tests in his first year, so let's not worry about that. Then he averages 43, 33, 30 over a period of time. Then he averages 23, 27, 20, 18, 29, 30. And then it's 42, 30, and 53. So essentially, it took him ages to become a really good bowler. Then obviously he's a great bowler in the middle. I think in 1959, he takes 54 wickets at 18. Ridiculous numbers, right? Very well suited to bowling everywhere as well, I think, at his peak, because he was a faster leg spinner. So there's nowhere you can't bowl if you're a faster leg spinner and you're getting and you're turning the ball. And so he was really good. And then by the end of his career, he's essentially almost goes back to being a part-timer, and his batting sort of takes over at that point, right? So I think if you then think of Benno that way, that's why his overall average is, what, 27? Whereas if you compare him with Jim Laker, if you compare him with Jim Laker, who was, didn't have as long a career, did he? I don't think. I think I'm right in saying that. Laker has like 2 years, 3 years, or one of them, he only plays one test, where he averages over 30. So it's when he plays multiple test matches. His first year, he averages 37. He then averages 14, 23, 23, 31, 10, 27, 13, and 19. So it's quite consistent. But if you think about Laker and Truman and why they wouldn't work in Australia, there were other fast bowlers in Australia. So Australia wasn't as worried about the fast bowling skills of Truman, right? It also would have taken away some of Truman's lateral movement skills, which he had. And in Laker's case, Laker wanted to bowl on either dust bowls or wet wickets. He wouldn't have got either of those in Australia. So it makes sense that those guys probably don't have as good a record in Australia. But yeah, I don't think McKenzie was an outstanding bowler. I think he was a very good bowler, but he certainly wasn't a great bowler. And with Benno, he was a great bowler, but probably just in that period when everything came together for him. But averages are misleading. That's why we do what we do. Gargis? I don't know. Can you select 11 from the squad of India, Pakistan? I've done this a couple of times already. There's no one from the Pakistan team that at the moment that would play for India. And not only that, there are backups for India who would be playing ahead of this. Done it multiple times. Bloody Bugger says, Dubai pitches have been slow, low bounce, less turn, hence less boundaries, but also hard to take wickets. Why the ICC don't make proper bowling wickets or flat run fests? It's not impossible to do in Dubai. You can do it, but they've just come off another tournament. The problem that we have in cricket at the moment is we are playing so many games on so few pitches. So it's the same pitches over and over again. And you get yourself to a position where they just get tired. And what you are seeing is cricket being played on tired surface. That's what it is. They just played the ILT20 on these wickets. And you can only use a couple of different pitches for televised matches. Major televised matches, anyway. And Moll says, the 100th best cricketer in the world right now would be top five in the world how long ago? Oh, God, and Moll, who would be the top 100th best cricketer in the world right now? It's probably a ways back. Top five in the world, yeah. It's probably a ways back, but like, I don't know, where would you have Kyle Jameson? Kyle Jameson was a pretty good bowler now. He's probably not the 100th, though, is he? He's probably a bit literally. Willow Rourke? Is Willow Rourke the 100th best cricketer? I don't know who the 100th best cricketer is. So it's a really, I think it partly depends on the kind of cricketer that you're talking about. But certainly if they're a fast bowler, fast bowls are so much quicker now than they were a generation ago and three generations ago. If you compare the paces of bowlers now compared to the paces of the 70s and 80s, we've had such a step up. So I would definitely say in that case that the fast bowlers would be there. The batters have all the advantages of having watched Javed Mehndad and Sunil Gavaskar and Gordon Greenidge. And even if they haven't seen them, like I don't know how much MS Dhoni saw of Michael Bevan, but does MS Dhoni exist without Michael Bevan? Probably not, right? Like that's how those things work. It's a tough one to answer because I kind of need to know who the sort of the 500th best cricketers are in the world. ABCD says, a bit off topic, but why are English so good at inventing new sports? I think a lot of English sports were invented by the elite, weren't they? Like, I think if you go back historically, although it's not quite true. They were made popular by the elite, or they were made famous by the elite. So if milkmaids made cricket and football really got big as a way of stopping gang violence in Manchester, don't know about rugby union. Rugby league is an offshoot of rugby union. I wonder if there is a colonial answer to this, as in sport becomes, there's so many people in England who didn't actually have to work because of colonialism, right? Because of the class system. That does that become part of it? Because, and then you've got famous rich people playing a sport, so they're going to be written about more in a way that maybe other countries didn't have. I wonder how much of it is also around the drinking culture. I know that's a weird thing to say, but like, so I was doing research on the history of cricket, and it's a project that I will get to on the main channel eventually. It's really fascinating. I think I've worked out some things that either aren't common knowledge or haven't been all the details being put together, but even some of the stuff, there's all these little pub sports that English, that you get in different parts of England as well that are related to cricket, but are not cricket. There is something about that has a part of it. But I do think that the sort of colonial class system is probably the answer if we're being honest. I've actually got this book, which is one of the best books I've read and has one of the worst cover images I've ever seen. Who's it? Alan Gutman. Alan Gutman, I mean, why have you picked this cover image? But the book is really, really good. It's not great on cricket if you know a lot about cricket, but it's very, very good about it's if you want an academic look at the sort of the history of sport. And I've got another one too around here. Even more fascinating, but I can't find at the moment. So I've got a couple of books about sort of the history of sport that I've been going through. I think this one is like an academic look at sport, and the other one is like the 5,000 years history of sport, I think. Or is this one the 5,000 years history of sport? Oh, this is the 5,000 years, and the other one is different again. Anyway, so maybe perhaps through those two books that I have at the moment, there might be a part of it that will illuminate it a little bit more. But my guess would be class system. My guess would be class system, printing press, industrial revolution, colonialism as a four things altogether. And English people are quizzes and stuff as well. Like, as I said, there are games and stuff around pubs. So there must be something within their DNA, not their DNA, but through the way that the country has evolved, I should say. Jack says, why overthrows awarded to the striker? Why misfields awarded to the striker? Why overthrows given to the bowler? I wouldn't do any of them. I don't understand them at all. Shrikant says, at what point did football surpass cricket in popularity in England? 1950s or earlier? It kind of depends on how you look at it. The English cricket team is really, really big, but probably winning the World Cup is the time it changed. But if you go back, there are pockets where cricket was still really, really big for a long time. The English cricket team was probably bigger than the English football team for a long period of time. But my guess would be the 50s. But again, I'm not an expert in it. But I think the Premier League really helped football in a way that never really, that cricket has never had. You know, the 100 is their first attempt at a proper Premier League, right? And I think that was when it probably really shifted from a media perspective. And you also get this other thing, which goes back to the question a moment ago from ABCD of, if you go back and you read in 1950, in the 1800s in America, cricket gets a lot more coverage than baseball. And that's a really interesting thing. And I think it comes back to the fact that cricket probably seemed bigger than it was in England, because the kinds of people who were writing about it were from that elite, right? And, you know, educated kinds of people. And the kind of people that were following football were probably more just everyday humans, right? At that point. And so it takes a long time for it to be noticeable that football has completely taken over, because counter cricket is still written about really seriously. People are going to league cricket games and the newspapers are covering all that stuff. Whereas actually maybe football takes over well before we even... there's any sort of media evidence to back it up. And that's the issue, is that, you know, I've always had this thing with, if you go back in history, what we really get is what educated people think at that time, right? And generally, educated people, especially back in history, are the elite. And they don't really have a broad spectrum of knowledge, right? Like, the Queen of England doesn't really understand English culture, right? I'm not having a go at her or anything, but she doesn't really understand culture in that way, because it's not part of her thing. You know, the best one is, of course, all the billionaires and everything out there. And I don't know if you know about this, but there's all these images of billionaires and the bottom of their shoes, because their bottom of their shoes are never scuffed up, because they never have to walk in places that would scuff up the bottom of their shoes. And the other one is, you very rarely see billionaires in coats, because again, they are dropped off somewhere and they get in. So to answer this question is almost impossible, because editors come from privileged backgrounds or then become educated and become part of that privileged system. And so they are still covering cricket. That, you know, when I started in 2008 in the UK, counter cricket was like a huge thing, right? A massive thing. So, like, as in, there were still like 7 or 8 people covering a county game, and sometimes more, sometimes like 10 or 15, right? And I mean, from newspapers and from the BBC and all these sorts of things. And that, there was no one in the ground. So there's still a legacy there. So I think it's a hard question to answer. Thank you very much to all the super chatters and all the Patreons. You help support us more than you could ever know. But even if you can't afford a super chat or a Patreon or anything, likes, retweets, blue skies, Instagram follows, all these things really help. Head over to Good Areas, support us any way you can, and we will see you again next time here on The Wagon Wheel. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly.
There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minvo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minvo.pro now.